If you enjoyed this episode of the Panel Show podcast, please leave us a review and hit subscribe wherever you get your podcast. Thank you for listening. Hey everyone, welcome to the Panel Show podcast. Each month we bring together two real journalists and two improvisers in character to talk about real world issues, topics, and events. This episode is being recorded on Saturday, May 22nd, 2021, live from our own homes over the internet via Zencaster. I'm your host, David Shore. Let's meet tonight's panel. First, our journalists. He's the Queen's Park Bureau Chief for the Toronto Star. Please welcome back Robert Benzie. Hello, Robert.
Hi, David.
And she covers Queen's Park for the Globe and Mail. And you can catch her Tuesday mornings on CTV's Your Morning and Friday nights on CBC's Power and Politics. Please welcome back Laura Stone. Hi, Laura.
Hey, David.
And tonight's improvisers are appearing as... She's the owner of Big B's Bakery in Bigger, Saskatchewan. I practice saying that a lot. Please welcome to the show, the not real, Brenda Butefield. Oh, hello, Brenda.
Oh, hi. Hi, David. So happy to be here. Oh, my goodness.
And Brenda, did I get your last name right?
Butefield. That's right. Butefield. Brenda Butefield from Brenda. Bigger. That's me.
From Bigger. Okay, great. Thanks for being here. And joining Brenda is the junior senator from the state of Vermont. Please welcome to the show the completely fake, cool Bernie Sanders. Hello,
hey,
Senator.
Hey, what's up, David?
Not much. We're still kind of in lockdown here, Senator.
Oh, not us anymore. I'm an anti-masker now, David.
Well, you know, it's good you can go with the flow.
Thank you.
All right, you're very welcome. All right, let's start in Ontario, where many people are wondering, has Premier Doug Ford ever met a land developer he didn't like? The Ford government wants to fast-track controversial Highway 413 in the Greater Toronto area. The highway was first proposed back in 2006, but was officially killed in 2018 by the previous provincial government. Now Premier Ford is working to make the highway a reality. The primary beneficiaries of the controversial highway are eight property developers who own 3,300 acres along the proposed route. Four of the developers are connected to Ford's Progressive Conservative government through the head of the party's fundraising arm or via former politicians acting as lobbyists. Most of the developers are significant party donors. Vaughan, Mississauga, Orangeville, and Halton Hills have all pulled their support for the highway, and more councils are calling for additional assessments and consultations. This has resulted in the federal government recently taking over the environmental assessment of the project, which is unusual. According to one report, drivers will only save 30 seconds in travel time by using the new highway, but the provincial government contends the highway is needed to meet future population demands. Here's two clips of Ontario Green Party leader Mike Schreiner talking about the highway, taken from a February 25th interview with CP24's Courtney Heal.
Well, first of all, I think it's just a waste of money to spend $6 to $10 billion building a highway that would save commuters 30 seconds, that will pave over 400 acres of the Greenbelt and 2,000 acres of prime farmland that is key to our food and farming economy and our food security. That money should be better spent in, you know, rolling out vaccines, paying for public health care, providing paid sick leave for workers, not paving over farmland. It will be far better to provide better access to public transit for the area. Bolton, for example, needs a GO stop. We need more GO trains as well as GO buses in the region. And I know there are concerns about truck traffic, but right now the 407 is way underutilized. If we can negotiate a dedicated trucking line to ship goods on the 407, this highway isn't needed.
So panel, do you think fast-tracking and building the 413 is the best use of the proposed $6 to $10 billion the project will cost? Laura Stone, why don't we start with you?
Well, first of all, I'll say I think the future of this highway is looking pretty bleak right now. I mean, when the federal government recently stepped in to do to propose its own environmental assessment, it was just one in a series of hurdles for the provincial government. So, and I think their tone has really softened on this as well. They used to be huge proponents of this, the Ford government, and they've kind of taken a step back from their passion, I would say, for the highway, because I think they're seeing this growing opposition and dissent. And you are kind of hard pressed to see a lot of people come out in extreme support of this, because as you mentioned, municipalities have come out against it. Obviously, environmentalists are against it. And now we have the federal government stepping in. So, you know, the Premier Ford did come in on a promise to revive this, but I would say that it's looking less and less likely as time goes on that this highway will ever actually get built.
Senator Sanders, I don't know how much you know about Canadian politics or Ontario highways, but what do you think about all this?
Well, to tell you the truth, David, I actually know quite a bit. Okay, this is this was part of my coming on your show. So, you know, I took time off. I'm a Twitch streamer now, just to let you know. So,
are you?
Yes, that's right. It's a cool new thing. I also have an OnlyFans account. If anybody can plug that right now, right off the top. Okay. I'll tell you this, David, highways make up 1% to 99% of all roads. Okay. Yeah. So if you take the 99%, if you put that down, you know, a lot of these people are saying, you know, it's going to take off 30 seconds away from someone's travel time. That's 50% of a minute. So 1% and 99% plus the 50%, it just doesn't add up. You know what I mean, David? I don't agree with it. I feel like everyone should get e-bikes and walk everywhere.
Okay, very interesting. And Robert Benzi, what do you think?
I think Laura's correct that the future of the highway is not particularly bright. I mean, there will be more highways built in Ontario, but I'm not sure that one will go necessarily from Vaughan to Milton, which is where this one is proposed to go, because there's really not the need for it right now. And it's one of these things that Dalton McGuinty, the former Liberal premier, first proposed this in 2006, and it was a sop to his donors, who were many of the same developers who supported the Liberal Party are now supporting the Conservative Party, because that's what developers do. They support the party in power. And it was a sop to them. And then McGuinty's successor, Kathleen Wynne, canceled it in 2018 because she didn't think there was any need for it. And she had also changed the donation laws by that point so that the developers couldn't donate money the way that they could back when McGuinty was courting them. And they really can't now the way under the same rules. But it's one of these things that I don't think Premier Ford wants to pay the political cost of proceeding with it. It wasn't funded in the budget. So there's no particular future for it right now. Maybe a future government looks at it, but it seems to me that it's going to die on the vine.
Brenda, what about you? What are people in Saskatchewan and yourself thinking about this?
Oh, well, you know, David, I am a rural girl from Bigger. And, you know, the thing that us rural girls is that we love our back roads. So I am not one for the highway. People are in a rush and I'm not in a rush. So I'm a back roads girl and I love the feeling of my truck tearing into a gravel road. So you're not going to see me lining up and voting for this highway. That's for sure, you know, but you can come down to Bee's Bakery and get yourself a gravel donut. It's just gray sprinkles, but it's a lot of fun. Very tasty.
Sounds delicious. Robert, you brought up an interesting point about how Premier McGuinty initially proposed this highway as, you know, for some of the same donors. And I'm wondering, like, you know, I was in the UK. I lived in Europe for like 7 years, I think, when McGuinty was premier, and then Kathleen Wynne came back to the end of her time as premier. But it seems to me like that has anyone else really acquiesced more to land developers and builders more than Premier Ford? Because I remember like a few weeks ago or a little over a month ago, there was that controversial, he changed some laws so that Amazon could build a warehouse over a wetland on land that was owned by some donors of his, when there was another proposed site about a kilometer away that wasn't, you know, the land wasn't owned by donors. And it just seems like Premier Ford is constantly looking out for developers and not the little guy, quote unquote, that he campaigned for. Is he doing this? Is it just me or is he just doing this way more than other people?
I'm not sure he's doing it more than other politicians have in the past. I mean, remember, Ontario has the reason we have the urban sprawl that we have is we've had governments for the last sort of 60 years in this province that encouraged it, and through you know, building highways and cheap land and building sewage where they built it. So I'm not sure. I mean, I know it's fashionable to vilify Ford for everything but I don't think you can blame him for being more in bed with developers than some of his predecessors. He's probably more in tune with them than Kathleen Wynne was. I think that's fair to say, but I'm not sure he's more in tune with them than Dalton McGuinty or Mike Harris were before Wynne or Ernie Eves. I mean, and the MZO, the ministerial zoning order that you're talking about with those were done by his municipal affairs minister, Steve Clark, that gave permits, which I don't think is proceeding as it turned out, but because of a local council opposition. But
well, Amazon pulled out. Amazon
yeah, I think
like,
or they,
we're not
that's
even
right. They pulled
this.
It. Yeah, yeah. It was a PR disaster for them. Yeah. But I mean, those aren't decisions that Ford himself makes. Those are made by his ministers. I mean, he's not particularly a micromanager. I think Laura would probably agree with me on that, that he's more of a, I don't even say he's a big picture guy. That's not even what I mean. I just think right. He's just not particularly down in the weeds on this kind of stuff.
Brenda, what do you think? Do you think it's just business as usual, another premier acquiescing to builders, or do you think it's worse now?
Oh, yeah. Well, you know what? They have a saying on my daddy's farm, which is, you're going to kill the plumpest chicken. And what I mean by that is that, you know, whoever is sitting on the throne of power, the plumpest chicken, so to speak, is the one who's going to get all the attention and is going to get its neck wrung at the end of the day. So I'm going to agree with my friend here who said, you know, is he worse than everyone else? I mean, I don't know. I don't even live in Ontario. But, you know, it's just, he is the chicken who's going to get his neck wrung at the end of the day. So anyways, chicken thighs, we do have those on sale for lunch at Brenda B's Bakery. Thank you.
Okay. Laura, what about you? What do you think?
Well, I think what we do see from the Ford government is a real impatience and kind of disregard for bureaucracy and red tape. And that's sort of his brand, you know, getting things done and moving quickly and not getting bogged down by bureaucrats. And I think that's the ethos we see behind these ministerial zoning orders, which is, you know, working with the local communities to get things done faster. And I think that's going to be kind of one of the defining legacies of Premier Ford's government is sort of to come in and make a lot of changes quickly. And while not always successful, I do think that's part of his political brand, part of the Ford family brand, and part of the brand that he's brought to Queen's Park, and that is you know, building things, getting things done, and kind of disregarding the norms that that tend to just to take a long time and get bogged down. He wants to move things along much faster.
Senator Sanders, I mean, you have a long history. Well,
call me Bernie.
Okay, Bernie. Bernie, you've got decades.
What's cooler than Bernie?
I don't know. Bern, maybe?
Oh, Bern? Call me Bern. Call me Bern.
Okay, Bern. I mean, you spent decades in public service. What do you think about all this?
You know what I think, David? I don't know if you remember, but a few years ago, I ran for president of the United States.
I do remember, yeah.
And it didn't go so well, twice.
Yeah.
And I can tell you what I see from this Douglas Ford gentleman is he's not doing so well. Okay, he's got the people on his side, that's for sure. But you know, I think he's got a lot of money behind him, and money behind anyone is that's bad fuel. Okay, what he wants to do is really invest in green energy. Okay, human waste is really big right now. Right. I know there's a lot of non-fungible tokens that are going on. This is a cool term that I've just recently heard. And unfortunately, I have to disagree with both Robert and Laura. I didn't really pick up the points, but just to be a contrarian, I'm going to disagree.
You're very true to form.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome. All right, let's move on to our next topic, vaccine passports. With the prospect of international travel starting up again, governments around the world, including Canada, are preparing to issue COVID-19 vaccine passports. But should you need a vaccine passport to travel within Canada or to go to local indoor events? Israel has one of the highest vaccination rates in the world, but before they reopened their businesses, people were issued a vaccine passport called a Green Pass. Green Pass is an app, but a paper version is also available, and Israelis need it to go to gyms, hotels, theaters, concerts, indoor restaurants, and bars. While it was controversial at first, people came to accept it. So panel, should Ontario and the other provinces and territories issue their own vaccine passports or their own version of the Green Pass? Brenda, why don't we start with you? What do you think Saskatchewan's going to do?
Okay, I got to say, I'm really worried about this. I am an avid curler, and a lot of my bond spiels happen in Moose Jaw. So are you telling me I'm going to have to get some kind of passport to get myself into Moose Jaw for a bond spiel now? This is wild. You know, I'll get jabbed, and I'll do it twice. But I don't want someone checking my papers when I'm just trying to get rock on ice, David.
I hear. Well, you just needed to enter the facility is the way it would work.
Oh, sure. Next thing you're going to want to see my underpants and make sure I didn't steal Lacey's. Okay. I don't want the government in my business when I'm just trying to get my curl on.
I hear you. I hear you. Laura Stone, what do you think?
I think it's happening, you know, regardless of what you think about it, because, you know, even if you see what happened in Ontario this week with the reopening plans, I mean, it's all tied to vaccine rates. And I think they're building in, you know, a 25 to 30% contingent of people who won't get vaccinated for whatever reason, whether, you know, it's age or medical conditions or just a desire not to. I think societies are truly banking on, a critical mass of people getting this vaccine in order to return to normal life. And I think we are going to see places like movie theaters, potentially require it, maybe even certain indoor restaurants, on dating apps in New York, for instance, there's people who can share whether they've been vaccinated or not. So mm-hmm. I think that this is going to be, this is very much a part of the COVID-19 recovery. And I think whether we like it or not, that vaccine passports are going to be part of it.
Yeah. And that's the other side of it. Like private businesses, like the government may or may not, like the Ontario government or Saskatchewan, maybe, because it would have to be the provinces here, right? It wouldn't be like the federal government. If they don't issue like an app, if they don't adapt something like the Green App, could a private business, you know, is it fair for a private business? Or if I'm going back to doing live shows, I'm immune compromised. I'm definitely getting two vaccines. But I'd be worried about someone coming in who's not vaccinated. Senator Sanders, what do you think about that?
Byrne, please, Byrne, call me Byrne.
Sorry, Byrne, I do apologize. Byrne,
well, I think this is a great idea. Look, I have recently, me and my wife have backed a new app developed by an ex-engineer of Tesla. And whenever you get your vaccine, you also get microchipped, okay? All those people who are thinking that is an actual thing, it is. It's a real thing.
It's real, okay.
Yeah. We're starting to develop it. And then we're also developing the infrastructure for movie theaters and restaurants that a moment when you enter the room, your body will be scanned and all your personal information will be sent to the managers of said establishment. And there'll be a small screening process before every location that you go into, say you're shopping for underwear at a Gap or going out for a night at the town at the Keg Mansion. Everything is going to be completely automated. So all your fears are coming true, but in a good way. Okay. It's going to be like Cyberpunk. You ever play Cyberpunk, David? That's a new...
I don't. Maybe I'm a bit too old for it. I don't know.
To tell you the truth, I'm a bit too old for all of this, David. This is really my team that's telling me to do this.
Really?
I'm so tired. I am so tired, David.
You're doing a good job, sir. You don't sound tired. You sound really energetic.
Oh, it's been all the Red Bull and double Americanos. Apparently, that's a real cool thing to have.
Robert Benzie, what do you think? Do you think it's a good idea? Do you think the provinces should put out green passes, and if not, do you think private business owners have a right to demand some kind of proof that you've been vaxxed?
Well, it's going to be an interesting test for of charter rights, frankly, David, because I don't think government can force people to get vaccinated, even though I personally believe that people should get vaccinated. I got AstraZeneca and I'm still here, and I'm dying to get my second shot when I can of AstraZeneca, but I think that you might see the Canadian Civil Liberties Association and other rights groups saying that private businesses couldn't refuse entry to somebody because of their vaccination status. Though, if I were a theater owner or owner of a bar or something like that, I would want in a crowded space to make sure that everyone was vaccinated for the safety of myself, my staff, and my clients, my customers. So I think it's going to be we're going to be in an interesting place. But as Laura noted, Ontario's reopening is tied to vaccination rates. Ontarians were leading the country, I think, right now with 61% as of this date have had at least one shot. And they're hoping to have, you know, be at 70% by the beginning of June. And who knows by the end of the summer how, what those rates will look like. So I guess you'll have this mass inoculation or this mass vaccination so that it'll kind of be almost moot because mm-hmm. most people will be vaccinated. But I do think that you'll to go traveling, you will need to be vaccinated because
you already
do. Yeah.
Yeah. It's, yeah.
You go to India, you have to have your yellow fever and your smallpox vaccines. And, you know, in places like that, they want to see proof of that. When I went there, I had to show like it was a passport. So I think that's what will happen with COVID-19. Because I don't think Canadian governments are going to want people coming from abroad who haven't been vaccinated.
No, I can't imagine any government wanting that. And I can't remember which country, but there's another country that has a vaccine passport. And the Israeli government's allowing those people, if they're coming to visit Israel, to use it as proof if they want to go into a bar or a restaurant or anything like that. So, you know, it could be beneficial. You brought up something interesting about the Canadian Civil Liberties Association. What do they call it?
Canadian Civil Liberties Association, CCLA.
I really think they're on the wrong side of history with COVID because, like, I wrote them an angry letter months ago because they, one of their spokespeople or someone representing them appeared at an anti-mask rally, you know, that it's against your civil liberties. And I'm like, this is a pandemic. You know, like, people are dying and it's the same thing. It's interesting. You know, when you think about people fighting for your civil liberties, you don't think about them fighting for something necessarily like that, something that's going to kill people. I know it's not on the list of topics I sent all of you, but if anybody wants to pipe in, Robert, do you have any thoughts about that?
Well, on that point, David, I would note that the CCLA also defends really some really repugnant people in terms of free speech, you know, like white supremacists and so on. They may say, look, we don't agree with these people, but we do agree with freedom of speech. So, and I think that I understand where they're coming from.
I
don't think they're anti-vaxxers or anti-maskers. I think they're about civil liberties first and foremost.
Yeah. But do you think there's a line there? I mean, Brenda, do you think, like, for me, you know, I don't know that I've ever sent them money, but I would. And I understand that, you know, I know that they've represented white supremacists and I believe in freedom of speech. But for me, the anti-vax thing is really because of my health, you know, and my mother. And I don't want to put people at risk. Brenda, what do you think about
it? Well, okay, here's the thing. You know, sure, should people be able to express their thoughts? Okay. But, you know, I'm not going to let some racist go off in a donut shop that I own because that's bad for business, David. So similar to that, you know, I sell masks at Brenda B's. You can buy them for $5. They got strawberries on them and they smell like strawberries. And so if folks aren't coming in with their masks on, I'm going to make them take one of Brenda B's Bakery's masks. Now, will I make a window for those anti-vaxxer morons? I might just suddenly find that the window is more expensive than coming up to the counter. And will I get sued for that? We will see.
Laura, do you have any thoughts about that?
I just think there's a broader conversation that's starting to happen about the impact of lockdowns and all these public health measures. I mean, people have been living this for so long and a lot of people out there resent kind of government interference, right? So, of course, COVID-19 is a real and it's a pandemic and, steps have had to be taken to rein that in and to save as many people as possible. But I do think there's now kind of just, I would say kind of a growing chorus of people who are looking at the impacts of it on society and kids and mental health and businesses and people's livelihoods. So I think that the conversation is broadening a bit and people are starting to kind of look beyond COVID to the impacts that this has had more broadly over the past year.
It's interesting because I think what a lot of people don't take into account is there are certainly there's going to be a lot of people who can't get a vaccine due to health reasons, and they're going to be counting on herd immunity. And people like me, who because of the meds I'm on for my Crohn's, the vaccine is not as effective. And I won't know if it's working right or not until I start going out in the world and if I get sick or not. Senator Sanders, Byrne,
please.
You have been a great defender.
Can I call you
liberties.
Dave?
I prefer David, actually, if you don't mind.
Well, or Dave. Fair enough.
I've never liked being called Dave.
It's how about D?
I'll take D. D's good.
Okay.
D's good. So, Byrne, you've been a great defender of civil liberties, but what do you think about, people who won't get vaccinated or don't want to prove they got vaccinated?
Look, I had to turn over a huge leaf in the past few years. To tell you the truth, I don't believe in free speech anymore, David. Unfortunately, really? I think some people need to shut their mouths, okay? No more joking around. I genuinely don't believe in free speech anymore.
Right.
This possibly is the real person talking and not the actual Bernie Sanders, but look at where free speech has got us, David. Look, we have people who are getting kicked out of parks, but we have people breathing their disgust with no masks on out in the open. I don't believe in free speech anymore. I think people should be forcefully made to get the vaccine. You know, we all got vaccines when we were children. No one's coughing about polio now. Why is this all happening? I can't get behind it, David. I think all this, everyone who steps outside, who doesn't have a good reason, should go directly to prison. I'm going to get physical. I'm not an old man, but sooner or later, I am begging you, please, do the right thing, or else I'm coming after you.
Okay.
I got all of the vaccines. So I've got Moderna kicking around in me. I've got Pfizer fighting it. I've got AstraZeneca. I don't care. I'll take everything right now.
Did you try the Russian, is it called Sputnik, their vaccine?
I tried it. I tried it twice. Yeah. I was in the clinical trials of that thing.
So you had it before Putin. Putin was very hesitant to get the vaccine.
I told Putin to get it. I was like, look, you can either spy on us more or take this. And he listened to me.
There you go. Senator Sanders, take
I talk
big.
About it all on my – I have a new Netflix anime series coming out. I go really deep into it there, so you should watch it. It's coming out soon.
Okay. We'll check – everyone to check that out.
Portishead is doing the soundtrack. It's great. You'll love it.
Do you even know who Portishead is, Senator?
I have no idea. I feel like it's – sorry, I was told it was cool. I have no idea.
All right. Well, it's going to be an interesting show to watch, that's for sure. All right. For our next topic, let's talk about work attire. Now, I'm an avid viewer of U.S. late night talk shows. And when the pandemic started, all the U.S. talk show hosts started broadcasting from their homes, and they all ditched their suits and ties and began dressing casually. Now, a few months ago, they all returned to the studios, and Jimmy Kimmel, Jimmy Fallon, James Corden, they all returned to wearing suits and ties. Now, I have an old friend, John Wilk, and he works on Jimmy Kimmel Live. And he told me, quote, that Jimmy went back to wearing a suit to try and show some semblance of pre-COVID normality, end quote. When Seth Meyers and Stephen Colbert returned to their studios, they remained casually dressed. I didn't notice this until one night, a pre-COVID episode of Seth Meyers aired as a repeat, and I found it quite jarring to see him back in a suit. It just didn't seem right to me. So I'm wondering, you know, after spending a year of working from home in sweatpants and pajamas, will there be a new normal in office wear? Will casual Friday become casual every day? Panel, what do you think? First of all, currently I'd like to know what you're wearing, you know, if it's not embarrassing. And just to let you know, because my air conditioning is not working well, I'm wearing a pair of shorts and that's pretty much it because it's hot as hell in my room that I'm recording in. But, you know, what are you wearing? And do you think the days of formal office attire are over? Robert Benzie, why don't we start with you?
Well, it's Saturday night, so I am wearing shorts and Birkenstocks and a penguin shirt, so I'm looking like a dad, I guess.
That's appropriate.
But I really, really hope that it goes back to people wearing suits and ties for men and women wearing office attire, because I do TV shows every week from my house, and I wear a suit and tie for that because it's professional, and it's out of respect for the people that I'm working with on the show, and it's out of respect for the audience too. I mean, I'm not just sitting around in my pajamas. Not that I don't have respect for your audience, David, but you're not taping us, or you're not videoing us. If you were, I would be wearing a suit and tie. As I did Monkey Toast Live.
Yes, you did. Yeah, and I always wear a jacket and a nice shirt. At the live shows and even at the panel show, the live shows, I was always adamant about proper attire. And I'm not saying people should start wearing pajamas to work, but I kind of like Seth Meyers and Stephen Colbert in a button down shirt or a sweater. I find it. What's wrong with that? I think they look good and they don't have to wear a suit. But maybe I'm wrong. Byrne, what do you think about this?
Oh, let me tell you, David, this is something that my team will not change, okay? Currently, I'm wearing some gray trousers. some diabetic socks. I have a 38 waist belt on. I have an undershirt on. I have a extra large blue shirt on. I have a wool cardigan over that. And as you can tell, I haven't brushed my hair since 1972. I am a man of style and substance. So I think I've never taken these clothes off. I sleep and breathe and eat in these clothes. I think everyone should start dressing even more formally. I think you should wear your suit and tie in the house. Get used to it. So when the doors open, we can start going back to work just like that.
All right. Laura Stern, what about you?
Well, right now I'm wearing jean shorts and a t-shirt because it is quite warm. I'm sort of, you know, I'm not as well dressed as Benzi. So I've quite enjoyed, you know, I'm business on the top, party on the bottom. When I do my TV hits, I wear my shirts and blazers, but I'm definitely not putting on real pants if I don't have to. And I must confess, I've enjoyed that a lot, but I think there is something to be said for, you know, showering in the morning, getting dressed, leaving the house and going to an office and kind of, you know, it mentally, it puts you in work mode. It gets you out of the house and it makes you civilized, I guess. But yeah,
I couldn't agree more, Laura.
First of all, work attire, changing in work attire does not mean people are going to stop showering and going to work. I just want to be clear about that.
So. No, but things have gotten a little loose during the pandemic. I think we all agree.
For sure. Well, of course. Brenda, what do you think?
Well, I just have to disagree with that one thing Laura said, because over here, things have gotten tight during the pandemic. And by tight, I do mean my pants. But I have been going into work, David. That's right. Right now, I am wearing some sweatpants and a sweatshirt, and they are matching and they are tie-dyed. My niece made them for me, and they are both covered in icing sugar. That's right. I worked a double today at the bakery. But, you know, I get up every morning at 3 a.m. to go in and make those farmers their donuts hot and ready to be had. And so, you know, I got my hairnet on and my glasses and my mask, and that attire is not really going to change. But what I haven't done in a full year and a half is put on a pair of heels. And I don't know if my feet are ever going to want to go back there. Even if I want the little lift in my tushy, I don't know that I can cram my stepsister feet into Cinderella's shoes any longer, since my corns have had a year and a half off of that imprisonment.
Okay. And panel, what do you think about Parliament, the Canadian Parliament? There is a dress code in the Canadian Parliament for men, at least. There's no dress code for women, which tells you how long ago the dress code was made and how outdated it is. But basically, male members have to wear a jacket and tie or a bolo to be recognized to speak. And last year during the pandemic, when Cape Breton MP Jamie Batiste rose to make a speech on Indigenous reconciliation, he was wearing a beaded Mi'kmaq medallion around his neck rather than a tie. Now, Batiste had given the Speaker of the House a heads up about his neckwear ahead of time. So when a Conservative MP raised a point of order, the Speaker confirmed that the neckwear was appropriate. Something similar happened last year in New Zealand when a Maori a member of their parliament, I believe, was wearing, I forget what it was, but it wasn't a tie, but it was something to the Maori culture. And they were not recognized. It happened three times, and I believe they were moved, and then they changed the dress code laws there. But what do you think, panel? Should the federal parliament keep the dress code law, or should it be changed or updated? Brenda, why don't we start with you?
I honestly think everyone should have to wear bolos, because those things are so fun, and they just, you know, they just bring back great memories of getting beat up by cowboys in small town Saskatchewan. That's wonderful. You know what? I think it's kind of silly that I do think it's kind of silly to these folks who are debating, you know, our lives and all that kind of stuff are going to get caught down in these rules about what to wear. Now, sure, yes, let's all be professional. I'm not going to show up in a swimsuit to the bakery, am I? But at the same time, when we're talking about our environment and our children and our health education and all that kind of stuff, do I really want someone not to be able to speak because they don't have the right pair of pants on? I don't know.
Okay, Robert, what do you think?
Yeah, I mean, I think it could be updated maybe, but I don't have a problem with decorum in that way. I don't think that MPs or MPPs at Queen's Park should be wearing, you know, jeans and a t-shirt as they speak in the legislature, because I think it's about showing respect for your constituents, showing respect for the institution, and showing respect for voters, frankly, that you are going to be serious about your attire. It shows that you're serious about what you're talking about. And I think that's why, like, I'm a big believer in journalists who cover politics looking that we dress like the people we cover. We wear suits and the women wear business attire, because the ministers and premiers that they cover are wearing business attire or suits. And it's a peer thing, I guess, and it's an equalizer. And it also is a reminder that, you know, they aren't any better than us, or they aren't any more, they don't have any more professionalism than we do. I don't know. I guess I'm old school on that, David, but I really do believe that there's nothing wrong with a bit of decorum.
Is it because you look great in a suit, Rob?
I do look great in a suit, though. You're right, Brenda. Okay. Thank you.
You're welcome. You're welcome. I did notice.
Well, you know, Robert, I do know at least one politician who doesn't wear a suit. And he happens to be on the show. Byrne, what do you think?
That's right. David, you know what? I gave up wearing a suit a long time ago. What I did was I bought one pair of extra large trousers. I bought one giant blazer. And that covers me year round, all year. Okay, but I gotta agree with Robert here. I do agree with decorum. You know, if you're gonna show up to work with, you know, flip flops and cut off jeans and a tank top and a visor, you know what? Now that I'm saying it, that sounds very cool. does anybody know, is Old Navy open during the quarantine? I feel like I should make a stop in there. You know what?
It is online. I've been ordering stuff online from The Gap, okay. Same company. So you can definitely order stuff.
Okay. You know what, Robert? I'm sorry. I'm going to have to disagree with you as I'm talking. I actually think we should flip. I think people should come to work in whatever they want. You know, it's really going to – did you ever go to private school, David?
I did, but we did not have a dress code.
Okay. Well, I went to a private school. We had a dress code. The dress code was very large trousers and an extra large blazer. And I felt like that really stuck with me from a young age. But right now, I think I'm having a real crisis, identity crisis right here and now on your show, David. But I think, you know, I've been wearing these large things for a very long time. I'm a very small man. I'm only 3.5 feet tall.
All right.
But I think, you know, I'm going to start looking into new things. I like what Laura's got going on. I'm going to do party on the top and party on the bottom.
Okay, that's good. Laura Stone, what are your thoughts?
I believe I'm with Benzie on the traditional element and the respect for people in parliament, but I'm also for some flexibility. I don't think it's reasonable at all to say, you know, an Indigenous person can't wear a symbol of their culture. It doesn't have to be a tie or a bolo. I have absolutely no problems with that. And I do think we need to relax it a bit, because style is changing too. And there's some debates that go all night in the House of Commons, for instance, and men can't even loosen their tie or take it off at 4 a.m. Oh. And there's been complaints about that. So, you know, I appreciate the tradition, but I also think people should be able to express their individuality in their own style.
Yeah, I have to agree. I also find it interesting, like for the men, like the requirement now, like it can be an old jacket, a ratty tie, but you can't wear, like everyone's like adamant, no jeans. You can never wear jeans where, you know, if you go to a jean store, there's some pretty expensive pairs of jeans out there. It's pretty fancy jeans. Whereas, you know, you can grab a jacket from like a secondhand store that's got holes in it, and that's okay. But anyways, that's
my style.
And I'm not wearing a shirt. That's your style, Byrne. There we go. It's Byrne Styles as well. And guess what, everybody? It's time for us to play Fact or Fiction.
Ooh.
Yeah. Each month, while doing research for the show, I come across a story that makes me think, this is the craziest thing I've ever heard. And then I find a few more stories that are just as crazy. So we're going to use some of these stories to play Fact or Fiction. I'm going to read a headline, and then I'll ask each panelist if they think it's a factual headline or fiction. Feel free to play along at home. Okay, our first headline. Two YouTubers, Count Binface and a man who drank his own urine. Who gets your vote as London mayor? Robert Benzie, is that fact or fiction?
I don't think it's fiction. It sounds factual, but I don't vote in elections, so I wouldn't vote for either of them. But I think it's probably factual.
It's like to say, Robert, more than anyone I've ever known, you're always dropping. By the way, I don't vote in elections, so you drop that in a lot.
I do. Because I'm so pure.
Brenda, what do you think? Is that a factual or fiction headline?
Okay. Well, you know what? I just really don't want it to be true that a man would eat his own fun juice. So I'm going to say that's fiction.
That's fiction.
And by fun juice, Laura's... I do mean pee. Thank you.
Okay. Laura Stone, what do you think? Is that fact or fiction?
I'm going to go with fact because it's weird enough for YouTube. To me, that rings true.
Okay. And Byrne, what do you think? Is that fact or fiction?
Well, I hate to tell you guys, but that's the truth. That article is about me, actually. I started my own YouTube channel. I'm a YouTube streamer now, and I was recently challenged to drink my own pee. But this is nothing new, because this is something that I've done quite a bit. I have colitis, and apparently the best thing for that is your own urine. So it's about me. It's true.
Well, let me just say it is true, but everything Mr. Sanders just says completely false. Do not drink your own urine if you have colitis. Go see a gastroenterologist. I have Crohn's. Do not drink your own urine. But that headline is a fact. It's from April 29th from the Guardian website, and it was referring to the London mayoral elections, which happened a few weeks ago. So that is fact. Let's move on to our next headline. Great-grandson of Lizzie Borden, Kirk Borden, to guest with metal band Lizzie Borden at Boston's Metal Fest. Fact or fiction? Byrne, why don't we start with you on this one?
Oh, you know what? I'm actually headlining at the Metal Fest. This is something my team has cooked up for me. But unfortunately, this is fiction. It's not Lizzie Borden's great-grandson. It's Lizzie Borden's great-niece who was once went to a summer camp with Lizzie Borden. And it's just a bit of a mix-up.
Okay, it's a bit of a mix-up. Laura Stone, what do you think? Is that headline fact or fiction?
Well, you know, it may come as a surprise that I'm not a metalhead. and I don't know anything about this. And I'm going to go with fiction because, you know, I cannot bring myself to care about anything to do with heavy metal.
Okay. Brenda, what about you? Are you a metalhead?
I am. You might be surprised, but I love to thrash about. That's true. My favorite metal band is Bison, which once, you know, roamed the great prairies of Saskatchewan. It's true. You know, and I want this to be true so mad because is there anything more metal than a woman just murdering with an axe? And I think the answer is no. And I do have a full back tattoo of Lizzie Borden going nuts on a donut. Thank you.
Okay, Robert Benzie, what do you think?
I think
fact or fiction?
Yeah, I'm not much of a metalhead myself, but I think this is fiction, and only because I was reading something about Lizzie Borden, the boarding house wasn't where she killed people. I think it's just reopened as a like Airbnb or some kind of bed and breakfast place, which is very strange. So I think that this is why, I think that's the Lizzie Borden story that's been in the news. I don't believe this is accurate.
Well, Robert, as a newsman, you do read the news, and you were right. It is fiction. And I also read that story and tried to spin something out of it, which none of you really believed. So there you go. You did a bad job. Okay. Let's go to our last headline. Bees in the Netherlands trained to detect COVID-19 infections. Fact or fiction? Brenda, let's start with you.
Okay. Well, you know, I love bees and they are smart little buggers, aren't they? You know, there's this hive right outside my bakery. I just got to say, I love them. You know, so I think, you know, you can't teach an old dog new tricks, but you can teach a new bee how to sting an anti-vaxxer. So I'm not sure if this headline is true, but I am going to train my bees to sting anyone that doesn't have a vaccination within my bakery's vicinity.
Okay. Robert Benzie, what do you think? Is that fact or fiction, that headline?
I don't know. I kind of hope it's fact, but and the weird thing is I have a friend who had Lyme disease and she used bees, her husband used bees to sting her to help cure her Lyme disease, and apparently it worked. I don't know if it's a psychosomatic thing or whatever, but it worked for her. Not that I'm recommending it for anyone else who's listening, but So I'm going to say I hope it's fact.
Okay. Byrne, what do you think? Is that fact or fiction?
Oh, this is fact, David. You know, I was actually privy to some of this information. Not only are they training bees to smell COVID, but they're training centipedes to smell tetanus. Okay. Oh. They are training children to smell for polio. And I'm actually now being trained to smell for opioids addiction, because that's a huge thing down here. So I'm just going around on the streets and making sure everyone's all right.
Okay. And Laura Stone, what do you think? Is that fact or fiction?
I'm going to go with fiction. I feel like I read a lot about COVID-19. Haven't heard this one. I could be proven wrong, though. And I'm not entirely sure how it would work. I'm very interested in it if it's true, but I think it's fiction.
Well, Laura Stern, let me say you are 100% wrong, because it is a fact.
Oh, my.
Yeah. And that is from May 8th from Reuters. I actually saw it on the Weather Network. So check your sources, Laura.
Cool.
The Weather Network has interesting, interesting stories. And guess what, everybody? That's the end of the show. Yay. I'd like to thank our panelists. I'd like to thank our panelists, Laura Stone, Robert Benzie, Christian Rasmussen as the not real Brenda Butefield. Is that right? Butefield, was it? I can't remember.
That's right.
Brenda Butefield. And Chris Siddiqui as the completely fake, cool Senator Bernie Sanders, a.k.a. Byrne.
No, no, I'm completely real. I am the real Bernie Sanders.
Music for The Real Panel Show is provided by The Real Jim Clayton. You can get more info about the show on our website, thepanelshow.com, and also follow us using Facebook under The Panel Show Podcast or on Twitter at Panel Show Pod. My name is David Shore. If you enjoyed the episode, please subscribe and tell your friends. Please stay safe. We hope you listen to us again. Thanks, everybody.